Yeah, it sure is. Along with Linda Moulton Howe. Conversations with Linda next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Linda Moulton Howe, and we're taking phone calls for Linda. Any speaking engagements coming up for you, Linda? Because you did get a little ovation when I mentioned your name at the X conference last weekend.
Well, thank you very, very much. I will be in Canada speaking in Vancouver, BC, at a college there, and I'll be there on the 10th speaking. And then I go to Kelowna, where there have been a lot of sightings of UFOs and apparently some people in the human abduction syndrome. And so I'm going to do some ground research, and then I'll be speaking in Kelowna on that next weekend, and then back here on the 17th. So it's going to be a very interesting trip. And all the information about these presentations you can find by going to earthfiles.com, and on the headlines page, just scroll down to where there's an announcement about this in Canada, and there's a click there to go to all the information about how to attend. And I have one quick footnote to the whole Phoenix confusion.
Sure.
The Phoenix New Times, on April 22nd, this is the day before the ABC 15 did that interview and said that they had found somebody who had watched the helium balloons and the flares be put together. The Phoenix New Times headlined, "Air traffic controllers who saw UFO muzzled by FAA," unquote. And the report begins, "Air traffic controllers in the main tower of Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport saw Monday night's bizarre spectacle of red lights flying across North Valley skies. But the Federal Aviation Administration won't let them talk to the media," unquote. The traffic controllers said they did not know what the red lights were, and that nothing showed up on radar. Now, the Phoenix New Times has filed a formal request with the FAA for radar records of any unidentified aircraft in the area between 8 and 8:30 p.m. on Monday, April 21st, 2008.
Jeez.
You think all this would happen around helium balloons?
Perfect timing. First-time caller line, you're on. Brad in New Buffalo, Michigan.
Hi. This whole food, turning our food into fuel, was a stupid idea from the word go, especially in light of Richard C. Hoagland bringing the thin film solar panels. It's right in front of our noses, and that's hydrogen. I mean, that's why Ford they're not going to go into hybrid vehicles. They're putting their research into hydrogen and diesel.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with BMW. BMW has discovered that liquid hydrogen is the way to go.
Or through hydrides. Are you familiar with this concept? It's been actually been in service about 20-some years ago, and then funding was cut. But that is working with metals that can absorb hydrogen into the metal structure so that the hydrogen cannot explode, and these hydrides can be built right into the frame of a car or in the trunk, and they can absorb hydrogen and then release it to power the car. And the issue is to have an infrastructure where people could pull into a gas station or some kind of a unit where they could then fill up the metal hydrides with hydrogen. There were cars that were being made in 1978 that had this ability, and they were driving then, and the only emission is H2O, water, right out of the tailpipe. I literally have drunk water from the tailpipe of a hydride-powered car. And it is amazing to me that we are not pursuing aggressively, like this is national security, if there ever was a national security issue. Why are we not aggressively pursuing a whole panoply here? Hydrogen, hydrides, fuel cells, solar, wind, all of it, everywhere, and to make ourselves as independent from fossils as possible. And I completely agree.
Well, I'm in the midst of designing a new engine right now for the marine industry, and there's a lightweight diesel that goes along with that. And on the wind issue, Ricardo has come up with a wind generator system, and instead of using the wind turbines to generate electricity, they're using the wind generators to turn screw compressors to store air. And that way, in off times when they don't have wind, they've got the air stored to still turn the turbines.
Right.
So there's a tremendous amount out there that can be done. And this whole food thing was just a stupid idea from the word go. As a conservative, I could never figure out why Bush signed on to this.
It's the oil.
Well, yeah, Shell Oil was just on PBS, and they're trying to get involved in our alternate fuels, and we don't need big oil involved in our fuel.
And, Linda, when you go to Clovis, New Mexico, check out who owns that ethanol plant. I'm telling you, there's something strange here.
Yeah, and, well, just look, 2 + 2 = 4. The oil companies have basically been in control of a huge amount of this economy for a long time. Now they are basically allying themselves or inserting themselves into this idea of food for fuel, biofuel, and they're getting a subsidy while they're making, what was it, Exxon made $40 billion profit in 2007, and they're getting a subsidy on this ethanol. There is something about all of this that, how do we break this kind of a system that keeps reinforcing the rich that already sort of run and control the world, when we need it to be all kinds of energy systems reinvigorated without the control of, say, oil companies?
I want you to track down, in addition to your assignment here to find the ethanol plant, call someone from the American Corn Growers Association. They told me 5-6 years ago that they could produce enough corn for just millions of gallons of ethanol and continue to feed the world. So I'd like you to chase them down too, okay?
That's why ethanol is completely backfiring. It is not true. And to realize that last year, with all of the corn that went into fuel, it only reduced our petroleum needs by 1%.
Let's go to west of the Rockies, Robin in San Francisco. Hi, Robin.
Hi, George. Always a pleasure to speak to you. How are you?
Thank you. We are fine.
How is your son?
He's well. Everybody's fine. A little grandson's fine. My little grandchild who has asthma, she's getting better. So far, knock on wood, everybody's doing okay.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. I was thinking of the surgery and the wisdom tooth, and I really related to that. And I'm sorry that Ephedra, the FDA did re-release it. Linda, they took it off and then they re-released it. It's been around for 5,000 years, and it is a bronchial dilator that cures asthma and pneumonia and all that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, many states made it illegal, so you can't get it.
Wasn't the downside, though, that it has...
The downside is they put it into herbal diet things, and one of the things is that you get a little energy boost. And so they used it for the energy boost and a slight appetite suppressant. And so people would take it, and they wouldn't hydrate properly. And I think they had exactly 3 deaths, which is less than what you get from aspirin.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm completely off subject here. What I wanted to ask about and find out more information and give you information is, how do you spell Morgellon syndrome?
M-O-R-G-E-L-L-O-N-S.
O-N-S.
And then syndrome.
And it's syndrome. Always beware of any time they have it classified as a syndrome.
Well, that's the CDC's. That's their preference. The medical community, like Dr. Randy Wymore, refer to it as Morgellon's disease.
Okay, good. That's good. The reason that I mention this is that I would be interested in finding out where the core start. Do you have any idea where the core start of this disease came from?
That's the
nobody knows
of an epidemiological study.
We don't know what male-female split on it.
Nope. We're talking about a disease that's only, by name, only 10 years old, no concept of it before a decade. And in the decade, the evolution of cases was at first slow. And now the number, Dr. Wymore said that they're getting so many more people signing up at their website, and they don't know if it is because there is more discussion in the media, or if in fact there is something more that is accelerating about the syndrome or the disease. And right now it is, I've talked with people, interviewed people who have it, and have it meaning they have the fibers coming out of their skin, they have the sores, they say that it is the most painful and horrible thing, that you can't sleep because of the painful itch. Well, you would think that with the fibers as physical evidence, so far not having been able to even be heated up so that they could analyze that there's something very strange about these fibers, and that there's neurological symptoms, you would think all of this together that there would be hard data about people at this point. But fighting all of this was, in the beginning, dermatologists said when people came to them, this is delusions of parasite, which is a form of neuroses, where people think that insects are coming out of their skin. And for, I would say, for 5 or 6 years of this decade, the Morgellon sufferers were up against a kind of classification that the disease did not exist, was not a disease, was only this delusions of parasite neuroses. So we're talking now in 2008, in which only about the last 4 years has anybody been taking it really seriously and organizing, and finally this breakthrough with the CDC. So your question is a good one. And it is a question the entire medical community would like to know. And everybody has been fighting preconceived notions and a kind of strange rejection that anything like this could be real. And maybe in 2008, if Randy Wymore is successful in 2 months from now with that laser ablation technique that he's working with the geologist, they may finally at least have compositional breakdown on the fibers. And once they have that, maybe they can start working backwards to source.
Okay, next up, let's go to our wild card line. John in Portland, Oregon, you're on the air with us. Hey, John.
Hi, how are you?
We're great, thanks.
Hey, just real quick, I've been listening a bunch about these spheres, and what's interesting is I'm just in a suburb right out of Portland, and I stopped by a guy's house who had it for sale by owner last summer, and he had a little card table and his laptop on there, and anyway, we were looking through the house, and we got to talking because I go to Oshkosh every year, the big fly-in, and he said he had retired after 20 years in the military, and he was an engineer and a pilot, and So we're talking about aviation anyway. He goes, "You want to see something?" And so he said, "I wasn't even supposed to take this picture," but he shows me his camera phone, and on it, over at the Oregon coast by Tillamook, they have these huge like World War One blimp hangars. And this guy showed me a picture of what he said it was, super super thin stainless steel sphere, and I swear this thing was probably 60 or 70 feet in diameter, or maybe larger. And he said these things are, that our government has these, and they go up into the sky, and they're observing, and you cannot even, he says everything around it will reflect off of it, so you can't see it. Now, I don't know that that's what everybody else is seeing, because I've watched all the videos and listened to everyone, but I know that we've got something, because I saw a picture of it on his phone. Then he goes, "You want to know something else?" He goes, "You know those big, like, Goodyear blimps that we've got?" He said, you know, on the side of the blimps, the big screen, you think it's like a TV to announce stuff? He said, those go way up into the sky. They listen to conversations of 100,000 people all over the United States. They can capture, they can be up like a few miles in the sky and capture whole masses of conversations occurring at once. And then we were just talking about different stuff. He goes, you want to know something else? Because he had just finished out here in McMinnville, we've got a Evergreen Aviation, which does a lot of work for like NATO and our Fed. In fact, they were got caught up in that scandal with the Iran-Contra thing years and years ago. Anyway, he was working on a one of those airplanes that is unmanned. And he said, and he showed me on his laptop. He said, this plane took a picture of the moon. And then he zoomed so far in on the moon, we were looking at little rocks on the moon. And my mouth just dropped. So it's just amazing. I know our government's got stuff we don't know about, and I really do believe that there's something else out there too. But I'm just, and I know this guy's name because I pulled it up off of the tax records from the house he owned, and I know where he moved in California. So if Linda ever wants to like try and see if this guy's interested in saying anything, more than happy to give her what I know about it. But well, I was just amazed.
Can you email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com? Because I really would like to follow up, and I have several comments. And George, I'll just go until you say we have to break, and I can pick it up on the other side.
Two minutes, Linda. Go ahead.
So this is really important, what you have raised. The classification of the spinning disks with lights inside and projecting symbols is something new. But the sphere goes back. The first person that I ever talked to was a retired military person from Utah Hill Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that around 1952... that he was there when a gigantic white sphere, maybe 300 feet in diameter, came down out of the sky, sat down, did not move, and it was not ours. He did not know what was in it, if we ever knew what was in it, because it was so highly classified, but it landed and he knew it. Now, that is a big, say, football field-sized white sphere. In my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, High Strangeness, Volume 2, High Strangeness, I have a fascinating interview with a man who was in Vietnam and was in the jungle and came across a large sphere, not 300 feet in diameter, but relatively large, and the entire surface was mirror. It's what you're talking about. And he said in the jungle that all of the vines and the green and everything was reflected in the sphere to the point that it was almost invisible, but that it had a very odd triangular symbol carved into the surface, which he drew and is in my book. And the engraving on this mirrored surface is part of what he could see, that it was not the jungle. There are other people who have encountered these big, large spheres in a number of places, including remote forests. I don't know.
Well, we got to take the break, Linda. Okay. We'll be back.
We'll be back
in just a moment.
Really important.
Okay. I'm going to clip off of Vacation Day tomorrow night. He and Punnett will sit in for us on Friday night, Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back with Linda Bolton Howe and Final Questions. Don't go away. Hey, Linda, before we take final calls, I'll let you finish up on this incredible story of this sphere that they found.
Right. And I was trying to get across to all listeners and the one that we were just talking to that there are apparently different surfaces on these spheres and different sizes. I'm very interested in anyone who has encountered one at any time. I would love to hear descriptions. And I was going to just give another footnote from my Military Voices section in Glimpses Volume 2, that the man was in Vietnam, and they actually, the sphere was associated with, quote, the humanoids packed up all their little instruments, packed themselves back into the craft, and left almost soundlessly. It sat there on the ground as the four legs resting on the ground with pads on them retracted back into the body of the craft, which was spheroid. Then it just lifted straight up off the ground. I didn't see any visible means of propulsion. There was little noise. Now, I would say it was a minimum of 50 feet, maybe 150 feet in diameter. It was very difficult to judge. It was a mirrored surface. So you're looking at something, and the jungle is being reflected, and it's really hard to judge the size. I know it was at least as tall as a five-story building. And then he goes on about what in the world would be the propulsion system for something that big, and that this had this etched symbol, which is very similar to the one that Lonnie Zamora drew from the egg-shaped craft back in April of 1964 that came down in Socorro, New Mexico, and the J. Allen Hynek investigated. It's very, very similar. Now, just this past week, I have talked with a person in Drummond, Wisconsin, who has twice there out in a wooded rural section where he goes only for deer hunting. He has encountered a very large sphere, and the last one was 5 years or 6 years ago. And he said, Linda, I'm walking in an area where it had been clear cut. So I could judge where the tree boundaries were. And he said, this thing had to be the size of a football field, perfectly a sphere, and it is coming at treetop level toward me. And he said, all the way around it, evenly spaced, were very large, copper-colored, copper-reflective, who knows, panels, and the top and the bottom also look like copper. And he said that in this clearing, if it's 100 yards in diameter, that's 300 feet in diameter. Imagine this, 300 feet diameter sphere. Gray-colored surface with these, what looked to him like copper metal panels, evenly spaced, and that it was moving in the air at treetop less than a mile an hour. And he said, I watched it cross this opening for 45 minutes with my mouth open. Now, what are these?
Yeah.
What are they doing?
And where are they from?
Where are they from? And if the caller is correct, if we've back-engineered 150 feet of diameter ones that are in these big hangars someplace, boy, if there's anybody out there listening who knows anything about what we've back-engineered that is spherical and is being used as what? Pilotless drones to monitor the population or what? I sure would like to know. These are really important, and we all need to know more about them. And the size alone defies understanding, because they're obviously, the propulsion system is not what we're used to in any kind of aircraft.
Back to the phones we go. First time caller line, John in Columbia, Missouri, not too far from where I am now. Hi, John.
How you doing, George?
Good, thanks.
I've got a question for Linda. In the country, in the last couple of weeks, we've been seeing lights across the skies, and I'm just wondering why it is that we see the lights. Why would they have lights on, like, giving away their position? If you could just give me a comment, I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, John, always a good question. If they're hiding, why have lights?
There has always been a flaunting aspect to this phenomenon. And I use that word flaunting very specifically in a discussion that goes back at least to around 1984, when I was still trying to develop and work on that home box office special that I write about in An Alien Harvest and what happened. The idea of... I just had a thought explosion. George, bring me back to this.
You did. We're talking about why do UFOs have lights?
Yes.
what they're supposed to hide.
I was thinking about a discussion. It's the flaunting.
Little too late for you, Linda, or what?
and probably too much allergy medicine. I'm suffering so badly from allergies. But the idea that in the animal mutilation investigations that there would be a sense that the animals are placed back to be found in the lights in the sky. Obviously, if it's advanced technology, unless there's something about the light itself that is necessary for the propulsion system, to have the lights that come on and go off in visible so our retinas can see them means they want us to see them.
Yep.
Because there are so many other incidents where it's very clear that whatever they are, they can cloak themselves in other frequencies. Let's say they can be seen only in infrared. And that means that the sky at any time around the planet could have a variety of technologies in it. And if it is somehow cloaking itself in frequencies that our eyes cannot see, it doesn't mean they're not there. It means that there are certain activities that are going on that are not ever supposed to be seen. And then there are other activities in which it seems they want us to become aware. And that ranges from the very repulsive animal mutilations to the beautiful lights in the sky. But as I always used to say long ago, the beautiful lights in the sky, that's the romance, that's the fascination. But what's in those beautiful, strange lights? And what is the interaction with the surface of our planet and under the seas? What is the agenda? That's what we all would like to know. If the government of the United States and Britain and Australia and our allies from World War I and II are in on the classified documents and completely agree on this policy of denial in the interest of national security interests, is it fair that people that are supposed to be elected in a democracy somehow end up with this private knowledge that all of us who work and pay taxes to keep this government going are forever supposed to be excluded from that knowledge? That, to me, is a fundamental question in our nation today.
Let's go to you, west of the Rockies. Hey, Bill, you're on the air with us.
Hi. Hey, George, you're doing a great show tonight, and I want to thank you for bringing great guests to us like Linda.
You are welcome.
And Linda, I've followed you for years. You've enlightened me. I learn something every time I listen to you, and I want to thank you for all your efforts.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to bring up, I just heard that there were multiple earthquakes down in Reno during the news break.
Yes.
4.2. Not real high on the Richter scale, but clusters of over 24. It'd be very interesting to hear follow-up if there were any UFO sightings 2 days prior to or the day of, during this period of time from that. And maybe if there's some kind of correlation between the earthquakes. I've seen that before in other reports of people making that correlation. I'm just wondering if you've noticed anything like that in your research.
Yes, absolutely. I remember a long time ago having a discussion with an abductee, probably in the 80s at some place. And the abductee had been shown something on a screen in a craft, as people in the abduction syndrome often do. They say that they're shown a screen and they're shown all sorts of things on it. And what they had been shown was that the disks were going to areas where there were seismic faults. And what they weren't sure, and this is really interesting, were the disks being shown on the screen because they were going to the seismic faults to monitor, to watch, to neutralize, or provoke. But the association between disks and earthquakes has been there for a long time in the human abduction literature. And that's partly the story, this incredible story out of Kokomo, in that area where that big earthquake was 2 days after all of the strange lights in the sky, all these MUFON reports, and that the photographs look so much like the Stephenville, Texas lights, and that here is this unusual earthquake there, and that over, oh gosh, I think the association between something in the disk category being in an area where there have been earthquakes, that that association goes back maybe 30, 40 years. What that would mean, I do not know.
Okay, thank you very much, Bill. Appreciate you being on the program. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're up. Hello there.
Hey, how's it going? Hey,
it's going great.
I just got a couple fast questions. First, I was listening to the BBC, as Linda was saying, and it's kind of a follow-up on the bees situation. They were talking about a great die-off of bats in the western United States. It was like littering the streets and stuff. And they said it was some kind of virus.
Yeah, I've done a big story on this at Earth Files. You can go to earthfiles.com, and it goes back a couple of months ago. And so all you have to do is type in the search bats. And what I'll tell you, this is really another huge mystery. When they have taken photographs inside of the caves, they find that a lot of the bats have a white ring around the nose area, and it is a form of a fungus, but they don't know whether it's opportunist upon all of these sick and dying bats, or if the fungus is related to the cause of what is happening to the bats. But here is another strange thing. The bats have to absorb and keep enough body fat to get through hibernation. And they have had people reporting in the New York area and places where these caves are that all of these bats have been dying, where people have been seeing the bats leaving the cave in the cold winter. And the only guess and the speculation on scientists is that these might be bats that somehow came out of hibernation and that they know that they are dying because they don't have any fat reserves, or something in the bat system is driving them in an urgent emergency situation to go out of the caves. And there are people who have lived around some of these bat caves back in the Northeast. They have never seen bats flying out of caves in the winter before now. Never happened before. And when they have analyzed these bodies, they find that they don't have any fat reserves at all. The bats are literally starving, hanging in the cave by the millions. They're just all crunched together and die from starvation, bottom line, and they don't know why.
It's first-time caller time. Alan in Arizona. Go ahead, Alan.
Yes, George.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Alan calling from Safford, Arizona. I'm listening to you on a station out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, when I do get it.
Very good. Go ahead.
I'm originally from North Dakota. It was back in the late 70s or early 80s. North Dakota State University did a study where they ran a farm or two in the Red River Valley of North Dakota. And those are not small farms. They ran everything on a diesel engine on sunflower oil. I met a guy who was going to school at that time. He worked on that project. But when he went to look online, there was nothing on it. And I just thought, well, maybe you guys could dig into it and figure out what happened to it.
Well, I think that when the professor earlier tonight said that it is the American Corn Lobby, and now it's the American Corn Lobby allied with the oil companies, that there has been this inertia to have ethanol based out of corn. But when you talk with some scientists, as I have, and with a professor, it is that there are much better sources, more efficient sugarcane is one, where you could get much more than you can get out of corn. And so right now we have policies that are miscued. They are politically and economically motivated, but they're not logical to people who know a lot about the processes, just exactly as you are suggesting, that there are other ways that we could make biofuels. And we are at a time where I think that the whole political kind of straitjacket that this country has been in for a long time, doing business the way it's always been done, it has to change for our nation to survive.
Okay, final calls here. Let's go to east of the Rockies. We've got Dale driving around in Georgia. Hi, Dale.
Hey, how you doing, George? Great
show. Great. Thank you.
Listen, I was going back to the Morgellons disease that Linda brought up there. I was wondering if anybody looked into the fact that maybe since this fiber didn't break down under heat, and we've got some pretty exotic materials on our space shuttles on the heat shields, that when these things are re-entering the atmosphere and coming in at superheat, this stuff is becoming airborne. Maybe some fibers coming off, and as this thing streaks across the United States to land and re-entry and stuff, maybe this is something that people are ingesting or inhaling, and their bodies are trying to expel it.
Dale, I'm not sure if it would come from the shuttle, but Linda, what about chemtrails? What if they're dumping some of this stuff on us?
Well, you know, the closest that I ever got to anything on the chemtrail research that seemed to have some sense to me is before he died, I talked with Edward Teller, and he had co-authored with actually two other scientists at UC Berkeley a paper about taking very, very small metallic fragments and dispersing them in a series of experiments to see where it was optimal, at various levels in the atmosphere, to bounce back photon energy from these metallic particles to slow down global warming. In other words, would there be a way that they could put these metallic particles to reflect back enough sunshine that it could make a difference on global warming? And he had done this paper. And I ask if he knew if a government agency had acted on this, and could they be doing it? He said, as far as he was concerned, no, but he did not know at that time whether or not anybody was researching with it or not. So that wouldn't be fibers in Morgellon. It may be something to do with global warming. But
thanks, Linda. Got to run for all of you. Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Linda Moulton Howe, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.